Want to find out who's on the Drew Marshall Show next week? Sign up for our weekly email updates online at drewmarshall.ca.
Well, the other week I was watching a bit of telly, and I can't remember what station it is, but I was watching, is it Steve Paikin? I think that's what his name
TVO.
Is. Yeah. The Agenda with Steve Paikin. And I saw Margaret Somerville again. And I said to myself, I got to get Margaret back on the show. Every time I see her talk in the media, she is one of the sharpest people I've ever heard. So please, welcome back to the show, Dr. Margaret Somerville. Hello, Margaret.
Hi, Drew.
I thought we played a little didge in the background there for
yeah,
you.
I can hear that. My cat's code didgeridon't.
Oh, that's funny. How are you?
I'm good. I'm fine. I'm just off the plane from Calgary, but I'm fine.
Nice, nice. Well, did you visit the 60-year-old mother of twins out in Calgary?
No, I didn't, but I spoke about it a little bit in a speech I gave on Thursday night.
Well, there's a lot of things going on in the media these days. Of course, that's why you were on the agenda with Steve Paikin. It was the theme was reproductive technologies gone wild, mm-hmm. from California octuplets to the Calgary 60-year-old mother of twins. So the question, I'll just ask you real quick, just I guess it was the question of the day with Steve Paikin, has reproductive technology gone wild? Just because we can do it, should we do it?
Well, no. There's some things we should do, and I think they're fine, and some things we shouldn't. And, I mean, what ethics is about is trying to work out which ones are okay to do ethically and which ones are not. I mean, it is being called, to some extent, the Wild West of reproductive technology.
Hmm.
And there's very big, you know, forces at work here at the individual level. The strongest one is individual people who for some reason or another can't get pregnant naturally and are desperate to have a child and are willing to try almost anything, right through to that, you know, it's estimated that reproductive technology worldwide is now a $49 billion a year industry.
Oh, my goodness.
So when you've got that kind of money involved, you know, there's a lot of other forces out there. So things, I mean, at one extreme, we're worried about what's called reproductive tourism. For instance, in India, they're building special luxury, they're more or less like hotels, where all these surrogate mothers stay for the duration of their surrogate mother pregnancy, and then the Westerners, usually it's Western people, come to pick up their babies. And, you know, you hear these awful stories, and just the commercialization of what is really our most intimate human relationship, that between a parent and the child, is very worrying.
Well, and one of the reasons I really have fallen in love with what you say and how you say it is, you're always standing up for the rights of the child. That was the first time you and I talked, because I think there were even death threats leveled at you back when you were going to be awarded some award at university,
yeah.
But yet you were against same-sex marriage, adoption of children, or something. Clear that whole thing up for us one more time.
Well, what happened? No, it was only a very vague death threat. I don't really think it was a death threat. It was only one thing. And but I did get a lot of hate mail. I mean, thousands of pieces of it. And what it was that, you know, I absolutely agree that there's been horrible discrimination against homosexual people and that that has to stop and that we should do everything that we can to make sure that doesn't happen. And one reason that homosexual people wanted same-sex marriage was because they thought it would be such a strong statement that of respect for them and their relationships. And I think that's true. And if it was just adults involved, I wouldn't have an objection to same-sex marriage.
Right.
But marriage is the institution that sets up children's most fundamental rights with respect to their parents, their biological origins, their wider genetic families. Marriage, as it stood between a man and a woman, was really a cultural institution built around a biological reality. That was its core, the fact that one man and one woman can have a baby. And, you know, you don't need any more people than that. You can't have any less. One by themselves can't have a baby. These days with new reproductive technologies, you can talk about cloning. But that's the natural reality. And I'm a great advocate of a primary respect for what I call nature, the natural, and life. Now, that doesn't mean we can't intervene on those things, but it means we presume we shouldn't until we can prove we're ethically justified in changing them in some way. And some of the things that we can now do, I think, are totally ethically unjustified.
Sure, sure. Margaret, you have that lovely, soft Aussie voice, so we're going to ask you just to speak up a titch.
Oh, okay.
There we go. You're there.
That's
fantastic. Yeah, that's better. Have you heard any decent argument that would suggest that the fertility doctor should not be held responsible for the octuplet scenario?
No, he should definitely be held responsible. He put back 6 embryos, and she got 8 babies, which means that there must have been 2 of the embryos that split to form identical twins. And what the new research is showing is that the chances of getting twins from one embryo, or the chances of those multiple births, are much higher when you've got in vitro fertilization involved than it is naturally. In Canada, there's no law on how many embryos you can put back, but the guidelines that the Canadian specialists in this area are using, this is what I'm told by them, is that up to the age of a 35-year-old woman, they put back 1 embryo. 35 to 40, they may put back 2. And over 40, occasionally they'll put back 3, but that's the absolute maximum. And some of the doctors say, and there's also some other research coming out, that maybe even your chances of pregnancy are better if you just put back 1. So there's still research going on that. But no, 8, putting back 6 embryos is outrageous.
No, it's ludicrous.
Yeah.
Well, and of course, President Obama's decision to fund stem cell research, apparently he's also been working relentlessly to force physicians to either kill unwanted children or refer their parents to other baby killers. I've been reading this quote here. This would be a Catholic website that came out with this terminology. What they're talking about here is, I think that babies who have survived abortion,
mm-hmm.
We're talking about that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
He's ensured that even more children will be killed by removing the ban from embryonic stem cell experiments while taking funding away from the very successful adult stem cell research, which kills no one.
Mm-hmm.
So where are you at with Obama's protocols?
Well, one thing that I think is inadvisable is to vilify him, and sort of I've been seeing things like, instead of saying hail to the chief, which of course is traditional in America in terms of the American president, it's been putting hail, H-E-I-L, which used to be Heil Hitler.
Right, right.
And I find that reprehensible, and I don't think it gets us anywhere.
No.
I think that we have to be respectful and courteous and listen to the arguments on both sides, and then try to convince people that some of the things that may be being allowed are wrong. And my position on embryo stem cell research is, first of all, there's an ethical principle that says that if you can do something without ethical problems in it, then you should do the thing that doesn't have the ethical problems, not the thing that does have the ethical problems. And everybody, almost everybody, there's a few people that are extreme on this, but even most of the people who are doing human embryo research, they themselves admit that there are ethical problems in it, although they think they're justified in doing what they do. So we need to encourage them to be sensitive to those ethics, and maybe they'll come around to saying we don't need to do this research using embryos.
So you know what's interesting about this is the reaction from the right down in the United States, now that Obama is in power, now that the Democrats are in power, is extraordinary. It really, they've shown their hand. The rhetoric and the reactionary nonsense that's come out of their yaps. I probably tend to side with the right on moral issues, etc., maybe more than the left, but I'm embarrassed to say I would have any affiliation with the right. I don't really, but I'm just embarrassed with their way they're reacting to all of this.
Well, I just sent off an email to somebody who runs a big website, and it was exactly sort of along these lines. And what I mused about in it, and I just raised this as a question, not as a statement or an allegation, but, you know, sometimes when we've got certain reasons for reacting in a certain way, we may not describe our opposition in those terms. And what we'll do is we'll focus on something else and be very nasty about the other thing. And so it did occur to me to wonder whether, you know, the language that's being used about what President Obama's done, I don't agree with him about the stem cell research, but, you know, that being said, the language that's being used to describe him, I wondered if there could be some racism at the bottom of this.
Oh, I wonder as well. I certainly do. Well, okay, now let's talk about just briefly these billboards that have been out there. I interviewed Pat O'Brien, the president of Humanist Canada, a couple of weeks ago, and of course, "We Can Be Good Without God" is sort of been posted at a few transit stations.
I'm not sure that we can,
but which is true here? I mean, do we need religion? You know, Bill Maher from Religulous, which is a great little movie, by the way. I suggested it to a friend of mine. She showed it at her. They have a little Bible study group with her church, and they said, "Oh, we can't watch this anymore." They turned it off after 10, 15 minutes because they were so offended, which frustrates me at the thin-skinned nature of the Jesus scene people. But do we need religion from your point of view, Dr. Somerville?
Yeah, well, Drew, religion comes from the Latin base of religion is re, ligare, and ligare means to bind together, and re just simply means to rebind together. And so religion is the way in which we share our social, ethical, cultural values. And it used to be that we did that through a religion that had a supernatural base.
But isn't it interesting that the definition of religion has to do with the coming together, and religion has been one of the most divisive things in the world?
Well, yes, that's because, you know, it was taught in a way that if you were one group and you'd come together, then the other group must be wrong if they'd come together with something different
right.
from what you thought. But you see, when we were isolated societies and you had more or less at least a dominant, if not almost a total consensus on religion in any given small society, you didn't have that problem. And now, of course, we're multicultural, pluralistic, interconnected globally, world societies. And so we have to ask, you know, how do we deal with that complexity of religion? I don't think it should be a problem. But I think that the people, like I call, for instance, Richard Dawkins, I call him a neo-atheist fundamentalist. And he got very offended when
really?
He said that. Yeah. Anyway, but you see, you've also got your fundamentalist Christians, and they're very similar. What fundamentalists do is they create what's called an either-or situation. For example, if you take Richard, he says either you believe in science or you believe in religion, and the two are completely incompatible. Well, I think that's just wrong. They're not at all incompatible. They relate to different aspects of being human. And the fundamentalists, too, I mean, I don't know how many there are, but a lot of people confuse fundamentalists and evangelicals, and they're not the same. The fundamentalist people read the Bible literally. They think it just means exactly what it says, rather than, they read it as what's called logos, rather than mythos. Now, a lot of people think myth means it's not true, but it doesn't. Myth is the way that we humans explain things that we can't explain directly in factual terms. And so, you know, they believe, for instance, that, you know, God created the world more or less as it is 4,000 years ago, and they're against evolution. I mean, you've seen the fuss in the newspapers this week
mm-hmm.
about the Minister for Science and Technology, because the Globe had a faint suspicion that might be what he believes.
Poor Mr. Goodyear.
Yeah, poor Mr. Goodyear. I know. But you know what? Even if he does believe that, he can still make his decisions about science without necessarily making his personal belief part of that.
The media will not allow him to do that, though. Why is that?
Well, because they've got a gotcha sort of, you know. I mean, it's pretty spectacular if you can say that your Minister for Science believes that the Earth was created in one piece 4,000 years ago, because the vast majority of people don't believe that. I mean, I don't believe it. I actually happen to have a friend called Paul Davies, who's a very famous astrophysicist.
This is the Stardust Theory.
Yeah, this is my Stardust Theory. And Paul believes that life on Earth originated from very tiny primitive organisms, living organisms, that were inside meteorites that were able to withstand the heat and pressure of the Earth's shield. You know, you know how the spacecraft blew up when it came through the shield? Well, these little meteorites came through in one piece, and these little guys inside survived. And in fact, the what are called extreme organisms that can live at huge temperatures and pressures, and they do around the mouths of undersea volcanoes. The scientists have been discovering them.
Of course, the direct descendants of them would be lawyers, correct?
No. The direct descendants of the guys under the sea. But anyway, so if you think about that, and Paul Davies thinks it happened about 4.8 billion years ago. I mean, absolutely stupendous time. And then, what I talk about is that we humans, because as far as we know, we're the highest evolutionary product of, you know, how life evolved. So we're this wondrous outcome of the combination of immense time and stardust. Now, does my believing that mean that I don't believe in God? Not necessarily, because it doesn't tell you who created those organisms or where they came from or what was the inception of the universe. And all of that, you know, it's quite legitimate through a faith lens to say, well, that was how God decided to do it.
Margaret, did you just say that you believe in God?
No, I said I didn't. I deliberately didn't. You can go back and listen.
Okay,
to
all right.
But
I was just
that
checking
doesn't it. Mean that I don't. It's just that.
Am I allowed to ask you about your faith? Because one of the reasons I like having one of the reasons I like having you on the show is because I don't connect, like, I don't see you as one of the Jesus crowd, okay? I know you as Dr. Margaret Somerville and McGill, Professor of Ethics and Law, you know, all this kind of bigwig stuff. I see you in the media. I see you being interviewed left, right, and center. And so much of the stuff that comes out of your mouth are the things that, and I know you've had a lot of people say this to you, you know, you're saying what I'm thinking, but I just can't say it the way you say it. And you're just so dadgum clear the way you say stuff. So for me to actually have some kind of an inkling that you might actually believe in God, I don't know if I want you as a guest anymore.
Okay. Well, you can keep. I have had a lot of people guess about that. And funnily enough, I did a big lecture for a group of high school students, something like 400 or 500 high school students, and they all sat there. And, you know, I did some of the spectacular new science and sort of ethical problems. So especially the little boys, boy, they were really onto this. They loved it. And so there's one little kid, you know, scruffy looking little kid, puts up his hand and says, "Do you believe in God?" So I had to try and sort of answer that. The reason I don't talk about my own personal belief in the public square is because I've had a long-term policy, in fact 30 years, of never speaking except as an individual. So I've never joined any organizations. I've never signed a mass letter. I've never joined a political party. I never submit an abstract to give a speech. I only go if I'm invited and paid for. I mean, I've had people ask me to put my name in to appear before parliamentary committees, and I don't do that. If the parliamentary committee invites me, I will come to tell them what I believe. And I do that because I'm sure a lot of people see me as an advocate, but I don't see myself as an advocate. I want to say what I believe, but I don't want to force it on other people.
Sure, but I would say, Margaret, that the merit of what you have to say would be slightly shattered if people did find out you were a God girl. And isn't that a shame?
Well, it's a terrible shame if that were the case. I mean, all conditional tense there. But I don't know that it would. I'm not sure.
Well, the reason I love hearing from you is because you say stuff clearly that I think, and I'm a God guy, and you're not, and I like hearing from people who aren't inside my tent, sometimes more than those that are inside my tent. But you know what I really want? Can you help Christian journalists, and I don't think any of them would listen to our show, as well as Christian leaders, and I know none of them listen. Can you
really?
No, I'm kidding. I'm being cheeky. Can you help them speak better in public? Because they need to learn from you today. I mean, some questions might be, you know, what questions should Christians be asking these days? What battles should we be fighting? And what mistakes have you seen the leaders in the so-called Christian right make?
I think probably their most common mistake is to speak in their own language. And so what I ask them to do is to think about who are they trying to convince. Are they trying to convince each other? And sometimes they are, because they feel they need that bonding and that strength and that religion, you know, binding together. But very often when what they're most anxious and sort of upset about is some of the things that are not going on within their religion, but are going on in what I'd call the secular public square. And they want to have a voice in that, and they feel that they're dismissed.
Hmm.
And actually, they're right to a large extent. But sometimes the reason they're dismissed is you can't get up and quote the Bible at a parliamentary commission. I mean, you can if you're using it in some sort of way that illustrates something you want to speak about, but you can't just say that because the Bible says that, that's what you've got to do or that's not what you've got to do, because that's not the way that we form public policy here.
Right, and we're not being very creative at all. I mean, people are very interested in spiritual matters these days, but they're not going to respond, as you've said, to sledgehammer, cookie cutter, predictable language or style of presentation.
That's right. Well, you have to think about how could I explain this to somebody in a way that they would welcome to hear about.
Right.
And the surprising thing is that almost all of what these people believe, you can explain it very well in what I'd call secular language. And so I think, my experience is that a lot of them are learning to do this now. I got asked to speak to the North American Catholic Media Conference about 6 months ago,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they wanted me to give the speech on. And, you know, I think they're very open to wanting to be able to do that. And I think they do it fairly well once they've got the idea of how to do it. But, you know, there's still a group of people, and these days sometimes they send me the press releases they're going to put out and ask me to have a look at it, because I know they know probably that I'll go off the deep end if it's done in a certain way, you know. And they still do it, you know. What it is, instead of being language that says, come and think with me about this, perhaps come and join me on this, It's alienating to people who don't belong to their religion or to that kind of discussion.
Well, another point that you raise, and I saw this in you, and again, that's why I wanted you back on my show again. When I saw you on the agenda with Steve Pagan, the people you were on the panel with, the two ladies who were in the studio, who came from a different point of view, they got sucky. Their mannerisms, their tone, their language, it was like they got all kind of huffy and immature and insecure and sucky about it. And look, despite the fact that opponents of our faith might be immensely disrespectful to religious people, I think it behooves us to respond with an attitude of grace and totally avoid cynicism.
I agree with you entirely. And in fact, you know, one of the things I try to teach is that respect is mutual, that you can't expect respect unless you give it, and you must give it. Although even if you don't receive it back, I still think you do better in your arguments if you're respectful. But I didn't see the show because I was on it. But I was told that by many people, that they thought that, you know, there was a lot of kind of condescension and sneering, one person said.
Yes.
I don't know whether that was true or not. But the other thing that happened was I nearly didn't go on that show, because when I found out the day before who the other four people were, I knew it was going to be me against four people. And I said, that's not fair. Anyway.
You held your own. You held your own quite well.
Well, anyway, after a lot of thought, I thought, well, if I don't go on,
They're
not going to hear any of the other side. So I decided that, you know, I better do it. But, you know, you'd be surprised. Well, maybe you wouldn't be surprised, but that happens so often. So often. I did a radio broadcast on PBS in the U.S., and it was on same-sex marriage. And it turned out, I didn't know this beforehand, but I was the only one who thought that there was any problem at all about same-sex marriage. It was total, total advocates on the other side.
So did you have fun with that?
Well,
my goodness.
I managed. I try to manage that by not getting upset, not getting hysterical about anything, and just sort of calmly saying, well, look, Here's another way you can look at it.
Well, and that's the Aussie in you, you know, the whole, she'll be right, you know?
She'll be right, Nate.
just before we say goodbye, boy, the time always goes so fast with you, Margaret. Thank you again. And on the line with us is Dr. Margaret Somerville. Can you give us an example of maybe a Christian that you know who speaks publicly the way that you might suggest would be actually influencing our culture, as opposed to simply contributing to the polarization or indeed even the alienation of public leaders of faith?
Whew. Well, some of the people that I know, you wouldn't know in Canada. I mean, I have a close friend who's actually a Jesuit priest. He's also a professor of law. And he's also an amazing man who headed up the Jesuit rescue mission during the massacres in East Timor. So somebody who kind of, and he lectures from time to time at Georgetown University. In fact, I saw him in Georgetown about 3 months ago.
What's his name?
His name is Frank Brennan, and he does a lot of work in the public square in Australia. And he's currently been appointed by the Prime Minister to lead an inquiry into whether Australia should have a Charter of Rights similar to Canada's.
Interesting.
Yeah, he'd be a good person for you to speak to. He's very, very articulate and very media.
What about Jean Vanier?
Oh, I think Jean Vanier. Oh, yes, I was thinking more of Canada, but because he's Canadian. I think, I mean, Jean Vanier is one of my heroes. Total heroes.
Hmm.
I had the privilege of being asked to write a blurb for the back of his latest book. And, you know, it was almost, I almost couldn't write it without crying, because it was just, you know, his stuff is so beautiful. And he's such an amazing man. And I think that series of letters that he's doing at the moment in exchange with Ian Brown in the Globe and Mail, I think it's just wonderful. I think it's, you know, it's superb. And I just wrote a piece that was in the Calgary Herald about 10 days ago called Dying as the Last Great Act of Living. And what I did was take things that I sort of knew, that I'd written about Jean Vanier, and use them where he's talking about the disabled people and what we've got to do to respect them. I think we need much the same approach to dying people. So I think he's got huge lessons to teach us. And I'll tell you somebody else, it might surprise you. I think Preston Manning's a remarkable guy.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think he's you know, he's a really genuine, authentic person, and he does a lot of, I think, very good argumentation on things.
I just wish he had a different vocal tone or quality, you know.
I know. It's such a pity. It's such a pity. Almost as bad as an Australian accent.
Oh, no, that's not quite as shocking as that. What about Henry Nouwen? Did you get a chance to meet Henry Nouwen?
I never met him, but I know his work.
Yeah.
And, you know, he actually lived at Lush.
Yes.
For a time. And I think his, yes, I've used pieces from him.
I had a great 24 hours or so, great time visiting the Larch community at Daybreak in Richmond Hill. I grew up in Richmond Hill, and I, Sister Susie, I had a great chat with her, had her on the show here as well, and just to sit and have supper at one of the community homes at the Larch community was an absolute thrill for me.
Well, Drew, a while ago, one of the Larch people asked me if I'd considered coming and living in Lush. And my sort of automatic response without thinking was, I said, I'm not a saint, a hero, or a martyr. And she looked at me, and I said it without thinking. And she said, you know, Margot, none of us are saints, heroes, or martyrs. We do this because of the fullness of life it brings us. And I thought, what a remarkable answer.
It is. That was good. Dr. Margaret Somerville, Professor of Ethics and Law. You want to go to the McGill website if you want to find out anything more about Margaret. I just so appreciate your heart. Thank you again for chatting with us.
My pleasure, Drew. Anytime.
Okay, take care, Margaret.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, so let's have a short break, and when we come back, we got to lighten things up a little bit. It's our free-for-all. We're going to play a comedy clip. We're going to read some abusive emails, whatever. If you didn't get through during an earlier talkback segment, if you need to vent about a guest we had today, well, now's your opportunity. Call in and talk about whatever you'd like, if you'd like to interrupt us, or just sit back and enjoy some chuckles, some random ramblings, and the odd email from both fans and critics alike. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.